In the Japanese martial arts system, it was just a level of refinement and polish.
Tim, I want to thank you for taking the time to come here this morning.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a long time coming. I mean, I think I asked you the first year I started. This is 3 years in now.
Right, right.
And finally you did it.
Finally we're here.
Because we were talking yesterday and I said, well, Tim, you ready to do it? And you said, sure, whenever you feel like it. I said, what about tomorrow? And you said, I'll be there. And here you are.
And here we are. Good.
Tim, where were you born?
So I was born in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Okay.
Mom and dad, I was sort of an only child. I had a brother and sister that were older. They had already moved out by the time I was
difference?
Born. Quite a few years difference. My brother was 25 when I was born.
Both, the same mother and father?
So mom and dad were both previously married.
Okay, so they had one child each.
They had one child each. And then they got together and tried
you.
For years and had me. So,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you still close with your brother?
Still very close with my family. We're a very tight family.
You have a brother and a sister?
Brother and a sister. My brother's in South Dakota. He was an educator his whole life. My sister is in Arizona.
Okay.
So I'm moving back to Nebraska. They're moving back to be, moving home to be with family. So.
Right. What about mom and dad? Are they still
mom
with
and
us?
Mom and dad not with us anymore.
Oh, they are not?
Yeah,
okay.
I lost my dad when I was 16.
Really?
Yeah, and then my mom, when I was 27, I think I was here when that happened.
Oh wow!
But yeah,
sorry to hear that.
But they left a very strong legacy with their children, and we are a very tight family. So.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So, what were you like as a little boy when you were growing up? Were you more academic or were you more sports minded?
That's a great question. I was curious. I was curious. I did a lot of reading, wanted to read things I was interested in, which could be anything from sports to trucks, you know, anything a little kid usually is sort of interested in. But I was also interested in sports as well. So
okay.
I had a little bit of both. So.
Did mom and dad read to you a lot, or was it one more than the other?
Yeah, I think they did. They read to me a lot. My dad would tell me stories. When I go to bed, I remember that quite distinctly.
What Dad type of would, stories? Like what?
Well, he'd tell me about the olden days.
Okay.
Right. He'd tell
Where'd
me.
Where did he grow up?
Well, he grew up in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
He was a boy of seven siblings. My dad was a doctor. His dad was a doctor. His dad was a doctor. It goes all the way back to the Civil
what
War.
What type of doctor?
Dad was a radiologist.
Okay.
So. Yeah, so he, as a radiologist, he was home in the evenings. So we spent a lot of time together, and I have great, very fond memories of my dad. So
okay, so the stories he told you were basically about the good old days.
The good old days. So he was born in 1912.
Okay.
So that's a lot. You know, he had a memory of first Spanish flu, the First World War, Second World War,
mm-hmm.
and he'd seen it all. I remember stories about the Boy Scouts when he was little, the teens, the 19, you know,
right, right.
Like before 1920, we're talking quite a long time ago. And he'd spend a lot of time doing that. And mom would come in and tell stories and read and that kind of thing.
What kind of stories did she tell you?
Well, what kind of stories did mom tell me? She would tell me stories about growing up on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
She was a farmer's daughter from Hamburg, Iowa. Stories of having fun on the farm. And it always the stories always reminded me of the, Dorothy, we're not in Kansas anymore sort
right.
of stories. She'd tell me about the tornado scares that would come and how they'd have to climb down into the crawlway and
right.
and whatnot. So,
where did you grow up? Did you grow up in a rural area? Or was it pretty much
right? So Lincoln, Nebraska is a city. So it was not a rural area. We were on the outskirts of the city. Walk out in front of the house, and the school bus would come and pick us up and go to school every day.
How big was your school?
How big was the school? Merle Beatty was the school in Lincoln. It was. It was an average-sized school. I wouldn't be able to give a number, but it was a school where we all came together. I still have friends from that school,
mm-hmm.
actually. I just texted a buddy of mine who was my best friend in first grade, actually.
Okay, so going through school, what were your biggest interests as you went through school, elementary, junior high, high school?
Yeah, this probably dates me. What date would it have been? I remember watching the Apollo moon missions, or was it the Apollo moon,
the landing.
The landing. The space program was fascinating to us in the late 60s, early 70s.
So going through high school, when you finished high school, did you have a subject that you really focused in on?
I suppose I was 14, 15. I started getting interested in boxing. So I wanted to, the sport that I chose, I ended up choosing was boxing.
What spurred that on? Wait, you said you guys were fair with each other. Did you have a bully?
In middle school, which we called junior high school back
right,
in the day,
right.
The neighborhood kids were, you know, sweet, and we were all friendly. Well, you get into junior high school, and now you're thrown in with a bunch of different
folks. Different areas, yes.
And first year, I was bullied a little bit.
Tell me what your little bit is.
Well, a little bit. What was a bullying story? It was just... Yeah, it was just a menacing feeling of this person is not as friendly to me as my friends back in the neighborhood were.
Dude.
One kid was on the bus. We were coming back from school. This would have been in sixth grade, I guess, before junior high school. And I can't remember what the issue was, but I was just getting picked on or something. And he's like, when you get off the bus, I'm going to, you know, get you. And I can't remember what words he used, but, it was like that. And I don't ever remember actually ever really getting beaten up.
You decided to get into boxing in high school.
Yeah, so I was boxing right as I entered high school. So I started boxing as a junior high school kid.
Who was that like?
Mom drove me. You know, we lived in a pretty nice part of town. Boxing gym was not in the nicer part of town. And so mom drove me there and dropped me off.
She didn't stand outside the boxing ring.
Oh, no. Oh, no, mom.
She didn't want to see you getting hit at all.
No, she never.
She couldn't stand that.
She never saw me fight. Now, at the gym, the gym was Sweet Nine, named after a bar called Sweet Nine. It was the sponsor of the club. And the coach, John Kubler, rest his soul, he succumbed to the COVID crisis.
Oh. But what John, age? What age was John?
How old was John? He would have been in his 70s, probably.
I was thinking, okay.
Yeah. But John Kubler was the boxing coach, and he was brilliant. You know, he would get young kids, and we had silver gloves and golden gloves. I came in as a golden glover. So golden gloves in the United States, the amateur boxing. So you come in, and that's the sort of age group, and that's the program you do. And so we came in, and everybody who starts boxing is scared of getting hit. But at that stage, if you get hit too much, it's really not good. You lose the confidence. You never really, really sort of get that back. And so he took people who, most everyone, you know, some kids come in and they're just already fighters. They're just, you know, bleed with their nose on everything. And but he didn't. He didn't do that. He really knew how to ease people into sparring without getting anyone hurt, build up that confidence, and then start turning up that sort of rheostat, and then seeing where kids go. And it's up to them, ultimately up to them, as to whether they want to compete or not. And competition is really important. I think putting kids in a, winning or losing really doesn't matter. I'll say it. I don't think it matters. I think what matters is getting through that nervousness and standing up and achieving that, of just standing up. I was telling my son the other day, 80% is showing up.
How old is your son?
He's 15.
And you have one son?
I have one son and one daughter.
How old is your daughter?
And Julia is 20.
20, okay.
Yeah.
Are they close?
They're very close.
That's good.
They're very
That's
close.
Good.
Yeah,
That's
they
good.
Know what each other are doing before mom and dad do. So.
That's good.
Yeah.
You've done a good job then. So what was it like for you?
Well, it was great for me. So, you know, you come in and your workout is skipping rope, you warm up, you work on the speed bag a little bit, and then you do 10 or so, 3-minute rounds with a minute rest in between on the heavy bag. And then if it's a sparring day, then you suit up and you spar. And so the sparring, it depends. You'll go with somebody who's more senior or not. But generally, if it's somebody who's been at it a while, and they'll sort of round robin it. You know, you do 3 rounds with this guy and 3 rounds with another guy, and you work that out. But John, knew that. He would tell people. People knew if you're senior in that gym, and you're going with somebody who's sort of a beginner, you're making a target for them. You're helping them ease into the thing and to understand what it's like to have somebody come at you, because right. that's not it's different hitting a hitting a heavy bag and actually
something moving right is a little bit different.
Is different. I saw it with the kids, especially, you know, the little kids come in 10, 12 years old, and boy, the confidence that just would gradually build up, you know, and it was great. And then after a while, they realize it's nothing at all to be frightened of. You know, getting hit isn't really, you'd never remember getting hit after a sparring session or a bout. There's never a single time, and most boxers will say this, that you just don't remember a time when you were hit.
Right.
You're thinking about strategy, you're thinking about getting through the round, you know, the exhaustion and all the rest of it. But it was he was a very, very good coach.
So when you go on to college, what'd you do in college?
So in college, so my interest was medical school. I wanted to go to med school like my dad did. And
did your older brother go to med school?
He did not.
Older sister?
My sister did not go to med school either, but my brother's son did go on to med school.
Okay.
And
so
he almost broke
the chain, but then he's made up for it by his son.
That's right. Okay. That's right. So yeah, I was sort of med school or bust. I was sort of focused on that through high school. In high school, I qualified as an EMT. So I, you know, went to community college and got the EMT-1 certification. So the next level is the full-on paramedic, for instance.
Right.
So there are these different stages.
Okay.
And that was really cool because I was able to work at Lincoln General Hospital. And I had worked there part-time since I was about 14 years old, doing odds and ends in the radiology department. So I knew everybody, and everybody knew me. And so I came in as an aide. So I was helping around the radiology department and just sort of hanging around the hospital whenever I could. And that was great. So I worked there all through high school and college.
So what happened? You didn't go into that profession, did you?
Well, here we are in Japan. And so that sort of enters the discussion of how we,
First of all, how'd you get here? Because you're in the States, you're working in this hospital. This is after college.
I also worked there after college.
After college, okay.
Yeah.
Did you have any ideas about coming to Japan? Had you traveled?
Right, so when I stopped boxing, I was probably 18, 19 by the time I stopped. Well, I got into university. And I didn't quite think that pursuing, so there's a point at which your amateur sort of career is like, do pro fights here? Would it be fun to like sort of go down the professional route? And most people don't, but I really like boxing. I love boxing. I mean, I was asked the other day, who was my hero? Who'd I look up to? Who was my sort of role model? It was Muhammad Ali. Everything about what he stood for.
But you didn't know this at the beginning. No one did.
Mm.
Because afterwards, when he started articulating why he was doing what he was doing.
Right.
Because the first thing he did was got attention by being the loud mouth.
Yes.
Black people, no one liked him.
Right.
And when you found out who he was fighting against and what they represented and what he really was.
Yeah.
Everyone did a 360.
Yeah. I don't know if you heard Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson has really done some wonderful interviews recently. He's really centered.
He's opened up. He's good. He's on point now.
Go listen to his talk about how he thought he would have fared against Muhammad Ali. I mean, I had a poster of Ali in my room, you know, all through high school, you know, and that was a real motivating force for me. It was great, and I saw boxing really turn kids around. You know, a lot of kids. You know, some of the first bouts, some of the first fights. This has been the 70s. Were in the Nebraska State Penitentiary. So we would go in. Our team would go in, and they'd set us up with the bouts with the inmates.
You fought with an inmate before?
Yeah. Yeah, we did that every year. We'd go in and they'd match our team up with the inmate boxing team.
Have you ever been knocked out?
No.
Have you ever knocked anyone out?
No.
Okay.
No.
So how many rounds would it be?
Three rounds.
Okay.
Three 2-minute rounds.
And unless you're going up against a Tyson,
yeah,
you wouldn't be knocked out.
No, no. Well,
or some, you know, some guys
people,
are crazy.
Some people are. Some people are really get caught.
Can easily, yeah. Yeah, get hit wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't think I had the, as I think back on it now, I don't think I had what is come to be known as the eye of the tiger. I remember one time I was winning, one fight I won, and the guy was not faring well at all. And I remember coming close to him and say, you know, keep your right up. I was saying, like, keep your right up.
Yeah, because it's too easy
I didn't want to, it was just who I was.
That's not the eye of the tiger.
No, I wasn't. But I love boxing, and I love getting in the ring. Getting it, you know, in with people in the ring, and it was really good for me at the time. And that was right at a time when my dad had passed away. Oh. And so that was a time when I was that really, and my coach, you know, stepped in and really understood what was going on, and the gym was really a place for me to go be strong. You know, I stayed strong. I built myself up from being a little kid to someone who had a lot of confidence. And then moving into college, decided, look, if I'm focusing on med school here, I'm not going to want to, this isn't something I want to pursue and continue. So I was introduced to Dr. Richard Schmidt at the University of Nebraska, who's the exercise physiology professor there. And he was running the karate program at the university. And so that was
my
first. And
you had never thought about karate at all?
Never thought
about it. That was not even in.
No, no. And that was a very interesting experience. The refinement of protocol and manners. You know, there's manners and etiquette, protocol in any boxing gym as well. I mean, it's not like it's completely non-existent. There are respectful things that you better follow as a team member. If you don't, it's not good. But in the Japanese martial arts system, it was just a level of refinement and polish, a focus on details that you wouldn't necessarily. It's hard to compare one to the other, but it was just a level of refinement. The history, the legacy of the whole thing really appealed to me. And I started studying Japanese after that. I was so interested in karate that I started studying Japanese at the
university. So in college, you took up, that was one of your classes?
Yeah, Japanese so I studied Japanese. Dr. Chang, Nellie Chang, everybody remembers her. She was
Chinese teaching Japanese.
She's Taiwanese.
Taiwanese,
lady.
Okay, right.
So she grew up speaking Japanese in Taiwan. Of that
so
era.
She's older. She's older lady. Yes.
Lady, okay. Lovely, lovely teacher. Lovely lady. And I remember sitting in class the first week or so, realizing, oh no, we actually have to learn to write and read this stuff. I thought it would just be like, you know, speaking. Oh no. And so there, you know, that's when the whole foundation began. It's like, okay, this is kind of cool. This is kind of cool. So.
So you get into karate, what mm-hmm. happens from there? Because you're also doing medical school as well.
Yeah, yeah. So so I was fortunate to have traveled a bit when I was young with my parents. So I think I was 10 years old. We went to Scotland and Ireland and the UK to visit relatives when I was young.
On whose side?
On my dad's, oh, my mom's side. And so we went there, and so I had, you know, sort of traveled a little bit. But coming into university, now you're exposed to all kinds of stuff, you know. It's and for me, it was like, wow, this is really, really interesting. Maybe med school isn't the only option here.
When you say all kinds of things, you had only been to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're saying you get into college and all of a sudden Asia opens up.
Asia opens up.
Africa's opening up.
Africa opens up.
All these areas you hadn't thought of.
That's right. That's right. And academic disciplines as well. It was like, well, hang on. It's, you know, political science is pretty interesting to me as well. So maybe majoring in political science, I can still get into med school. I'll be a sort of an outlier It'll distinguish myself among the other applicants. And so I switched a major over to political science, which had an international component to it. And that all of this sort of intersects together into a trip to Japan after about a year with my friend, my fraternity brother, who was a Japanese lad. And I came and did a homestay with him here. So.
And you're doing martial arts at this time?
Doing martial arts this time.
How many years had you been in martial arts before you came here?
I think the first time I came here, I bet I had been doing it 3 or 4 years,
probably. Well, so
you'd
really been involved. So what belt were you at?
I was a purple or a brown belt when I first came here.
Isn't that one before black?
It's one before black. There are three levels of
brown belt. Oh, there are?
Yeah, and so I think I was the first level or second level of brown belt. And I had an introduction to Okano Sensei, who is the founder of Kenkojuku Shotokan in Hachioji, which is the oldest Shotokan karate dojo in Japan, therefore the world, actually.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, because I told you a long time ago, that's the style that I studied.
Right.
Shotokan, yes.
Right.
So you come here with your friend, what year was that?
That would have been 86 or 87, I think.
Okay, that's the year I got married, 86, here at TAC.
Oh, was that right?
Yes.
The old TAC, yes. Yeah.
Got married here at the old TAC.
That's wonderful.
So you came in 86 or 87, and then you stayed for a year, where?
Didn't stay for a year, it was just the summer.
Oh, just for the
just
summer?
Just came in the summer.
But it wasn't a homestay.
Well,
then.
It was homestay for the summer.
Okay, for the summer, okay.
I stayed at his place, we came for the summer. But one of the reasons for coming was to go to visit the Honbu Dojo.
Was your friend also, was your?
He didn't have anything to do with karate at all. But he helped me get around and got me sorted out. And I had a letter of introduction, and for those who are my age or older, that actually means a letter of introduction. There was no email.
No text message or anything.
No.
Right?
So my original teacher was Dr. Schmidt, and he arranged for a letter to be sent to Okano Sensei introducing me. I'm coming in this period of time. And then I had a separate handheld letter and gave it to him. And I arrived at the dojo, my name is Tim Neely. I hardly spoke any Japanese at all. I'd been studying a bit, but I I wasn't conversant. And so that was on a Monday. And he said, oh, yeah, that's great. I was waiting for you. I got your letter. I was waiting for you. Come with me. So my friend leaves, and I'm with him. He goes, you can go back on Friday. And I'm like, whoa, I'm staying in Zushi. My friend's home was in Zushi. I need to go back there. Nice, comfortable futon out, mom's cooking, all the rest. He goes, no. You stay with me until Friday. And there was not a lot of conversation. It was just, that's what Sensei said to do. That's what we're going to do. So I slept on the second floor tatami mat in an old World War II issue Japanese sleeping bag that he had for me. Hot summer, so you didn't need any, it wasn't cold or anything.
Right.
And it was a wonderful experience. We'd wake up at 7, and he'd take me to all the classes that he taught Tai Chi, and he taught karate at various places.
Would you do it in a gi?
Yeah.
You brought your gi with you?
I brought
you?
My own gi,
okay.
Yeah.
Did he let you wear your belt too?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience. And I met his son. His son's 3-4 years younger than I am. And his son is now the head of the school. So he and I are like brothers. We've been together since the 80s, so.
Oh, yeah. That is nice. Yeah. That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
So where'd you go from there? So you come back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
You finished college now?
I had not finished college. I was probably a junior at the time, right. Going into my junior year.
Right.
And that was wonderful because I came back with this fresh sort of view of the world, really. Coming back into university then was fantastic. And I stayed the course. They had a very strong and robust karate program at the University of Nebraska. Probably 80 people in the dojo. I mean, it was a big old coliseum, the old Coliseum at the university had this huge, there were three basketball courts that weren't used anymore, almost exclusively for us, for Dr. Schmidt's karate program. He also taught kendo, naginata, and some of the others, other martial arts too. And so that was just wonderful. And so, you know, the junior, senior year was really fueled by a passion for that.
Yeah. So what happened? Would you go from there? Did you know you were going to come back to Japan after you came the first time? Had you thought like that?
No, I was still thinking of med school.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
Yep,
so.
Yep. And
what did you graduate with?
Graduated with a political science degree.
Okay, what
about the medical? And a minor in Asian studies and pre-med. So I had all the pre-med stuff out of the way. Thought, well, what are we going to do here? I'm graduating. I came to Japan one more summer.
But your father had already passed.
My dad had already passed away. Yeah, so it was just my mom and I. And so I came back to Japan one other summer.
Why?
Same thing, study with Okano-sensei.
This time by yourself?
This time by myself, but still stayed with, it was another friend I had. I stayed with him back and forth, same sort of thing. And that was great. So I stayed with Okano-sensei then. Went back, graduated, and in the decision of, what are we going to do now? I applied to Keio University for a graduate level Japanese language program. It was in the, Bekka, it was the what they call the Bekka program. It was a separate sort of curriculum set up for people studying Asian studies, for example. And within that, there was the Japanese language program that they had created for people who were coming to go to grad school in Japan. So it was its own separate sort of program. And I did that for a year and a half. And that was wonderful. And when I told Okano-sensei that I was moving here to study, he was just delighted. And of course, you'll come every week on Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, and I've got this for you and that for you.
And he did.
And he did. And he was my guarantor. I remember arriving, and he and his wife took me to the local department store. And bought me all of the, silverware and, plates and stuff that I needed to live, alone. And we didn't live alone. I lived with a roommate and my buddy from Nebraska. He was also here.
Was martial arts, he had nothing to
he
do with it.
He did martial arts.
Oh, he did
well.
Too. Okay,
yeah,
so both of
still
you did.
Does. Yeah,
okay.
He still does.
He's still good friends.
He's
okay.
Still here, yeah.
He never left.
He never left either.
Okay.
Yeah, we've both been here since.
Is he
since
in Tokyo?
Then. He's still in Tokyo, yeah.
Yeah. He's not. Is he a member?
He's not a member.
Okay.
We've been trying hard
to get him in.
Yeah, myself and some of the other members have been trying hard to get him in. But he is the founder of a great company called IconicWineJapan.com. He's doing really well. He's in some of his wines they serve at TAC. So yeah,
that's good. Yeah. Okay, so you come back the next time, and you've been. Given all of your utensils for cooking and doing everything you do, you have your roommate, he's also in martial arts. Mm-hmm. How does it go from there?
Well, year one goes by, I graduated in the summer, finished that program in the summer, and thought, well, maybe I'll work for a year, just to let the language, solidify in, and we'll go from there. One thing led to another, and I had my first job offer, and that was with Harley Davidson. So Harley Davidson had just—it's completely unrelated to medicine, of course, but or anything else really.
If you think about it.
Yeah.
Harley Davidson. You put your information out there.
Mm.
To who? Did you apply at Harley Davidson?
Yeah, well, so I went through the Shushoku Katsudo with all the other, the job search stuff with all the other Japanese students as well. I was just one of them and, wanted to be treated just like everyone else. I wanted to go through that program and the job offer that I got. Japanese universities, all companies recruit, not all companies, most, big companies recruit from Japanese universities, and it was just part of that whole recruitment process. And Harley had just purchased the subsidiary from an old trading company called Balcom, which was a really old, it was an interesting history with that company. But they held the royalties and the rights to BMW, Harley Davidson, and a bunch of other brands from the time of the war. I mean, just after the war, they had built this business in Japan. Well, Harley had just purchased that subsidiary, and needed somebody to be a marketing and sales liaison between the head office and in Japan. I went through the interview process and convinced them to try me out. Harley had just purchased this subsidiary, so they had their own company now, Harley Davidson Japan, and it was led by a pretty famous guy in the history of Harley Davidson Japan called Okui-san, who I do have a sense of gratitude to Okui-san for hiring me. I didn't come from a business background per se, but many of the students coming out of universities didn't either, right? They just come in to choose a company and they go from there and they start studying. You enter a Japanese company as a new graduate, and maybe you've got an econ degree or a degree in English literature or whatever, and then you start training, right? It's on-the-job training. And that was in the 90s. That was, you were talking 92. That was wonderful, wonderful. It was just a very interesting experience. The employees welcomed me, knew I knew nothing. I was a marketing and sales liaison.
Okay.
Was my title.
Did you have to get a Harley?
I didn't need to get a Harley,
but you did.
I didn't, because we had a garage full of brand new Harleys.
But you never rode.
I rode, yeah.
When did you ride?
I rode in those.
You got your license. You got your license here.
I got my license in the States.
Okay.
And used international.
International license here.
Yeah.
It's easier that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And I didn't get my Japanese license until just last year. So I went back and got my Chugata and
Ogata. You're talking now.
Now, yeah.
How old are you now?
I'm 60.
So you got it last year?
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you decide to go back and get
it? One of my clients is a motorcycle manufacturer, an e-bike manufacturer. So I'm now, I get to it, I suppose, but I'm a consultant. I have my own consulting practice here in Japan.
Okay.
One of my clients is a interesting and innovative e-bike motocross manufacturer. I thought, I've got to have a local license here. I can ride on the international license, but you really need to have it. And the training was great, right? To go through that whole process.
Oh, you did. You took the 2-week test.
I took the course.
The course. What is it? 2 weeks, I think.
Well, it's 17 hours.
17 hours, right?
Yeah. So that's over about a month, actually.
Oh, it took a month. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's the Ogata.
Right, and you got your Ogata.
I got the Ogata as well. With coming here and sort of understanding the Japanese traditional approach to educating people on a certain task or skill, and we do this in the martial arts as well, meticulous, fundamentals, kihon, and looking at the motorcycle police here, there's a reason, they sometimes get in accidents, but there's Japanese police motorcyclists.
Oh, yes.
It's quite rare.
Of course.
And it's because they have an extremely high skill level. They train at it.
If you see them, they're probably some of the best in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they are just phenomenal.
In the course, and I wanted to take the course because I wanted that sort of very, basic stuff. And it's really hard. I mean, we can get on, anybody can get on a bike and sort of ride down the street, sort of figure out how to do it. But when you've got to think about look left, look right.
Right. And how you look left. It's not just look left. It's right. How you look left.
Right. Yeah. and keeping all of this stuff in mind and keeping the course correct puts another factor in your mind, which you will get on the street trying to figure out where to go. Do I turn left? Do I turn right? Is there a car? Is there not a car? It's kind of brilliant when you think about it in a way. It's a high bar. But in the course, they said, well, you're taking the course and here's what you need to do to pass. But let's talk about the actual driver's test. What do you think the the passing rate is, 50%, 25%. And he writes down 0.1%. It's like statistically, they don't pass anybody unless you take the course.
That's what
I loved it. I loved the whole the whole system. I liked the detail, the approach to the teaching, and then the skill acquisition that you get from it. You know, first day of this course, I mean, three people crashed. I mean, dumped the bikes.
Because it's stalled. They stalled.
It stalled on a corner or something.
Right,
fell. And they tumbled. And I'm like, oh, geez, this is. I never drop the bike. I'm pretty good on. I mean, I used to ride motorcycles when I was young, without my dad knowing. But I thought back, you know, the skill, this sort of skill acquisition, right? It's really a good program. I recommend it for anyone who thinks they want to ride, to take courses and to practice. I think back to the 90s when I was at Harley and we'd take, you know, the big bikes out. And I think back now, it's like, wow, how did I, you know, I knew none of this then. And yeah, I never stalled the bike on a corner or anything. I probably could have done it better, you know, but it was a wonderful experience both then and now. You know, this was a one sort of bucket list for me to get that done.
So how long did you stay with Harley?
I stayed with Harley for a couple of years and then worked in the advertising industry for, I was a account executive for Volvo Cars Japan. So that was a big deal for me. I was there for four years of, you know, motor vehicle marketing, sales, business basics in Japan. As many of us know have been in Japan, as a foreigner in Japan, you're afforded opportunities that you might not get back home, for instance.
And especially the level of opportunities.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to get back home.
Yeah.
Unless you're in the right, you know the right people, the right things. But here, being a foreigner is the right thing.
Yeah.
But you had a couple of things. You're a foreigner and you came out of KO.
KO, the name really opened some doors.
Todai Waseda. You're good.
Yeah, it really did. And I was able to meet very senior people. I mean, Harley, the second month I was there, I had, you know, Len Thompson and all, you know, I met Willie Davidson. I met all these people I never would have met
in the
back
US,
home.
Right.
And we had the Japan connection here, and they would go through me to communicate and all the rest of it. And it was just really a wonderful experience. I've got a love affair for two bikes right now, and I can't. And what I'm doing is I'm going around to dealers and doing test rides. That's my hobby right now. So I'm getting a lot of practice on a lot of different bikes over the weekends. And some places will let you take it for like two, 3 hours, yeah,
oh,
or more.
Yeah, yeah.
Bike.
You go right down here by close by Shibuya, that Ducati's place right there.
It's I've gone to the one over in Mitaka.
Okay.
There's a lovely lady over there that's trying to sell me either a Multistrada or a Desert Axe. They're a nice looking bike. But I also can't get my hands off this Ninja 1000 SX. And there's something about that bike. It's not way over. It's up a little bit.
That's what we need. Yeah.
And it's a touring bike, but it's also got a bit of rocket to it as well. So I don't know. I'm gonna try to ride these things and see where it takes me.
Have you looked at the BMWs?
I did. I rode a 950 and wasn't so impressed with the gearing.
Okay.
It was a little clunky to me.
Was it?
Maybe it was me. Sport mode was better than the normal mode, but it just wasn't quite as. Of course, I'm used to during the course was the NC 750 Honda, but I really was comfortable on that motorcycle.
Yeah.
That 750, really nice bike. But anyway, yeah.
So where do we find you today, now, Tim? What are you doing these days?
So
you haven't told me about your Japan. Can you kind of give me some idea?
That's really who I am today. I've lived in Japan longer than I've lived in the States.
How long have you lived here?
what's it, 34 years now.
You never had any feeling about going back at the beginning? And
well, yeah, I sure did. I wasn't the guy to give up my homeland, right?
How long was it before you said, okay, I'm going to probably stay here?
Yeah, it wasn't one time. I mean, I still have ideas of going back and forth.
You still have your U.S. citizenship, don't you?
I sure do, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I've got my my permanent residency here and U.S. citizenship, which I'll never give up. But I, you know, for me, I've got two homes. I love Japan. The longer I'm here, the more I fit in. I feel that I fit in, both culturally and language-wise. I'm not Japanese and don't try to be. But yet, with each passing year, I assimilate more and more and more. As I've stayed the course on the martial arts front, professionally, you know, I've been a consultant. I've been doing consulting.
What type of consulting?
So when I worked for IBM. Let me back up before that. I started my own consulting company after I worked in advertising and helped companies come to Japan and just sort of worked it out on my own, what that value proposition looked like, and just sort of built that small practice. And then was picked up by IBM. I also worked with a firm for a while, and I have a number of experiences. IBM was a very critical time in my career. It's sort of the time where I sort of came of age professionally and really learned the craft of advisory and what it means to put a proposal together, to tap into the needs of a company, and to offer a value proposition for them in a way that they can't refuse. It's compelling enough where they really want to work with you. That was wonderful. And I have, you know, worked in consulting. Recently, I was a partner at KPMG, and that was sort of the pinnacle of my consulting career. I left that to run a company called Clarivate Analytics, which is, I was the president of the Japan branch, where we took that global organization to an IPO. That was a wonderful experience as well. And now I'm operating my own small boutique consulting firm, and so helping clients on a bit of a smaller basis, but it's great. It's a lot.
What type of clients do you look for?
So clients that have a unique value proposition in Japan, so something that doesn't exist maybe or is quite competitive here, but companies that have products or services that are unique to Japan. I'm also quite interested in helping Japanese companies become globally integrated players abroad, and that's also an interesting thing for me.
I think it's quite needed as well.
Yeah,
it always has been from the time I first came up until now, and I think it will continue to be.
Right,
because
right.
As long as Japan stays the way that it is, which I can't see it changing, it's been over 3,000 years, I think.
Right, right, right.
They've done a lot of honing to make sure that it's what it is.
Right. I've worked with a lot of Japanese clients, a lot of Japanese, you know, stakeholders, and I feel that Japanese companies have so much to offer, you know, and there's that, there are those unspoken gems within the organization that really can be leveraged in ways that, other markets can benefit from. And how to, call that out and make those things, nurture them, make them blossom in ways that foreign consumers or foreign business partners can appreciate and can understand what's happening here. What is the opportunity, with working with Japanese companies? And so I'm not at all cynical on any of this. I just think that whether you're an American company coming to Japan or a Japanese company going abroad, you know, the need or the opportunity, I should say, to understand what you have to offer. I think Charlie Munger put his finger on it. I think it's attributed to him when he said, you know, companies that have figured out what they do really well, better than anyone else, amplify that thing, and then go find people who need it, is sort of a model for success. And I've tried to emulate that, actually.
I think you're the perfect person for that. I always look for people like you who've been in Japan for a long time, yet still love their country, wherever they're from, and can help bridge that gap.
Right.
Because we understand the society, first of all, they've been taught, don't be the nail that sticks out.
Right.
And that's what you're actually asking them to do.
Right. Right.
And they need that conduit, someone like yourself,
right,
that can do that and say, look, you're not sticking out, you're actually fitting in.
Right.
If you want to be global, right, you've got to do this.
Yeah.
And that, I think it's, I wish you all the best for this. Tim, before I end, there's always a question I like to ask everyone. Mm. If you could go back in time, knowing what you know now, and speak to a younger Tim and give him advice, how old would he be and what advice would you give him?
Wow, that's a great question. I don't think I would have guided me in a different path that I took. Perhaps I'd have said, just relax and learn. Soak it all in. Don't be anxious about where things are going. It's all going to be fine. You're exactly where you're supposed to be right now. And you're going to be where you're supposed to be 5, 10, 40 years from now. And live for today. I think that's the message, I would say.
Fantastic. Tim, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lance. Great to talk to you.
I want to thank all of you for watching or listening to this podcast. And never forget, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.